Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. You've probably been hearing this morning about the classified Pentagon documents that WikiLeaks made available to the New York Times and NPR and other news outlets. They're classified risk assessments about the prisoners detained at Guantanamo Bay. They reveal that one-third of the 600 prisoners already released from Guantanamo were deemed a high risk to U.S. security. At least 12 of those who were released have since joined the Taliban or al-Qaeda, according to the documents. One former prisoner is now fighting with the rebels against Gaddafi's regime. And we now know that most of the remaining 172 detainees have also been deemed high risk, including many of the 89 prisoners who are still due to be released. To explain what these revelations mean for the Obama administration, the future of Guantanamo, and national security is Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at the NYU Law School. Karen, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me back.
Were you surprised to wake up and turn on the radio or open the paper and see this document up?
I was surprised, but I wasn't surprised by the content so much as by the fact that all this existed and now we might have a chance to look at it.
Not surprised that at least 160 of the 600 prisoners who have been released were deemed high risk?
Not surprised. I mean, I think the way to view it is like this. This is a matter of detail and level of intensity, not a difference of kind. And we've always known that the screening process for bringing people to Guantanamo, of finding out who they were, and the screening process of letting them go has been based on many factors, including country of origin, our diplomatic relations with other countries, our lack of knowledge, etc. So, and I doubt this is a surprise to most people who have been working on the Guantanamo issue since the very beginning in 2002.
These are prisoners who were released either to their country of origin or to whatever country would accept them. Was it a condition that they'd be incarcerated upon arrival into the new country?
There were several cases, not that many, in which there was some kind of incarceration at the beginning of their return home. There were other instances, let's say in the case of the United Kingdom, where they were turned over and the British authorities were then given the chance to determine whether or not they wanted to hold them in custody, and they determined that there was no evidence by which to do so. I think there is an understanding with many of the countries, both home countries, but certainly when people went to third countries, that they would be surveilled and watched very carefully by the host country. So there were a variety of arrangements that were made that had to do with either incarceration or considered incarceration or some kind of surveillance.
Do you know if the standards for releasing someone from Gitmo have changed from administration to administration? The vast majority of these releases happened under the Bush administration, and that's probably important to clarify. 537 under Bush, just 67 under Obama. Why did the Bush administration, with all their tough talk, release high-risk individuals when they could have kept them at Guantanamo, and have these standards changed under President Obama?
Well, I want to address this issue of high risk. We still don't know what the criteria by which we determine high risk is. One of the things that's been reported in this recent leak is that high risk included, and again, this is something we'll have to learn more about, but that high risk included those people who said threatening things to their captors. So if that's a determinant of high risk, I'm not sure where that would figure on the scale of people who have training, means, know-how, networking, etc., who are people maybe others, including myself, would put in what I would want to be the highest risk category. Now, getting back to your actual question, it's true. The Bush administration let out actually just under 600 who went home. or went to third countries. And it was because they made the calculation that, in essence, Guantanamo was not serving a good purpose, that they weren't going to be able to try these guys. They didn't have the kind of evidence they wanted. And they really didn't have ways of assessing that they were dangerous or not dangerous. I mean, anybody who's been incarcerated without access to a lawyer, without due process, in rather harmful circumstances as at the beginning of Guantanamo, may leave with some kind of anger towards their captor government. So the Bush administration made the calculation that despite the fact that there might be this kind of newfound resentment against the United States, they were going to let go those people who were not deemed to be of the highest value danger. And I think that's the issue that needs to be clarified here and going forward. It's not just high risk, high danger. There are all different kinds of criteria by which to understand this. I think the Bush administration understood very early on that they had a population of people that weren't the individuals they thought they were, that hadn't been involved in plots, that were not high-level operatives. It's why they moved the 14 high-value detainees there late in the process to sort of make Guantanamo a place where the most serious active al-Qaeda, et cetera, jihadis were.
Listeners, if you have any comments, if you've been following this morning, read the long, long article in the New York Times on this, or heard some of the NPR reporting, as NPR has been doing a lot of the analysis as well. You want to give a call for Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at the NYU Law School, on these classified documents released to WikiLeaks and then to news organizations pertaining to detainees at Guantanamo Bay, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And here's Darcy in the East Village. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, it's Darcy. The first thing I saw thought of when I saw the Times article, and as soon as you started discussing these leaks from WikiLeaks, whether it's about the detainees in Guantanamo or Gaddafi's nurses, the most important issue should be discussed by the media and reporters is that Bradley Manning is sitting in solitary confinement, and we're learning about all this stuff that would have been impossible without him, and that should be constantly reported on. Even this wacky president came out and said he was guilty until he's even gone to court, and God knows when that will be.
Darcy, thank you. Now, I don't know that we have evidence that this particular release to WikiLeaks came from Bradley Manning. Should I assume that it's not because he's been in custody for too long now? Karen?
No, you shouldn't assume that. And it's been reported a number of ways, so I'm not really sure how to say this, and I want to talk to people outside of the media that maybe can give some kind of answer on where these came from. But what you can assume is that it was most likely or probably came from yet another piece of the WikiLeaks that had not been released.
I see. So
that's
maybe
one possibility, and that may be right.
And do you have any opinion on the treatment of Bradley Manning and the charges against him, like aiding and abetting the enemy?
The charges against him are not something that I'd really like to comment on. However, his treatment in custody is something I think we should comment on. I don't think it's a mistake or a coincidence that President Obama said on Friday, I believe it was Friday, that he knew what was going on with the treatment of Bradley Manning and that it was okay because, you know, he committed crimes against the United States. This is somebody who's been charged on 24 counts, who has not yet been tried. He needs to be tried before we start condemning him. But I think the worst issue here is that he seems to have been in a category that is a little bit outside of what we normally expect of those in custody in the United States, whether they're in military detention or in a federal prison. And the idea that he is in a special category that resembles to some extent in terms of him being condemned as a national security criminal and who is therefore deserving of a certain kind of treatment makes me wonder about the issue of enemy creep and how the way we've treated it. People at Guantanamo may someday come to affect American citizens, which he is.
Yes, and I wonder about enemy creep in terms of the charges, too, which you said you didn't want to comment on. And not that I really know what's in the mind of Bradley Manning, but the evidence that I've read about seems to indicate that he's for, maximum transparency, even if some radical notion of it, not necessarily that he's out to help Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I mean, we're not really sure what he did, and if he did this, then what his motives are. His motives may have been personally based and not politically based at all. May have been about, we don't know. We actually don't know, and I think it's very hard. When the United States government charges people, or the military process charges people, they will often pick a wide array of charges, knowing that under a plea deal or before they get to court, maybe some of those charges will have been dropped or changed or, you know, revised one way or another. Right now, this is what they want to charge him with, which is, you know, aiding and abetting the enemy. And, you know, in essence, what they feel he has done is treasonous. And so this is the category he's in. But I think this trial is supposed to start somewhere in May or June. So I guess we'll see. But the conditions he's in are just intolerable, I can imagine.
Bob in Rutherford, you're on WNYC. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Brian. I just had a question whether or not it was legal to insert some sort of tracking device into prisoners before they were released so we could find out where they go and who they associate with.
Bob, thank you. Did they do that, Karen?
I don't think that is customary under American law. I'm sure that there are, you know, theories of how we run our spy networks, et cetera, but I don't know that that's ever been suggested in a legal framework. So it's not something I've ever entertained seriously.
Bob, thank you. We do know, according to the NPR and New York Times reports today, that 12 of those released joined the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. NPR reports that about 30 more have returned to terrorism or insurgency in some way or another. What do we know about these 40 or so released detainees?
You know, we know basically what you've said with more of the details filled in. I mean, I think, is your question, should we have known ahead of time that they were going to rejoin the cause? Is that?
I'll ask that.
Yeah. Look, what our government's been telling us for a very long time is that they don't know how to make these calls, and therefore they're keeping everybody at Guantanamo. You have to assume that if you have a policy of release, there is no 100% guarantee, any more than there is with some of the most heinous crimes committed outside of national security and terrorism, that there isn't going to be some kind of recidivism. The fact is that when these people are released, no matter how we assess them, they should be under some kind of surveillance. And so, I mean, you have to make these decisions. Do we want to keep people in indefinite detention, something which I think steps over legal lines that this country should not want to cross? Or do we want to accept the burden of making wise judgment calls about who is dangerous and who isn't? And the fact is that we did not make good judgment calls when we took them in, and we did not make good judgment calls when we let them go. And from beginning to end, Guantanamo has been fallen into a sort of intelligence vacuum of a sort, and we've never quite figured it out.
As we talk about the documents released via WikiLeaks regarding the detainees at Guantanamo Bay with Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at the NYU Law School, the Obama administration has said that 89 current prisoners are due for release. Some of them were deemed high risk, according to these documents. The president ordered a new assessment of the detainees in 2009, and that new assessment was not released here. So I guess it's possible that these prisoners set to be released are not deemed high risk any longer.
I mean, that's possible. But once you match up who was, you know, deemed to be released and those who are considered under this document to be dangerous, you can, you know, decide how to make decisions about what he did. I mean, what I think this is going to do is give President Obama more leeway and more power to claim the right to use the category of indefinite detention, which is, as I said before, a problematic category and one that he has basically embraced since May of 2009.
Of the 172 prisoners who are still there, 47 of them are deemed too dangerous to release, but are also deemed too hard to prosecute in military or civilian trials. And this presents such a legal and ethical quandary. Here's the president in 2009 talking about this group of detainees, too dangerous to release, but for whatever reason not eligible for trial.
Let me repeat, I am not going to release individuals who endanger the American people. Al-Qaeda terrorists and their affiliates are at war with the United States, and those that we capture, like other prisoners of war, must be prevented from attacking us again.
So what do we know about those 47 people, and what would make them, if they're deemed too dangerous to release, what would make them also not candidates for trial, even a military tribunal?
Well, okay, that's a lot of questions, and they're all good. Let me start, though, with the last one, which is, you know, what would make them not triable even for a military trial? The UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, is based on the U.S. Constitution. And while it does have a number of, you know, exceptions for how people can be tried, it is still a system of justice that is very much recognizable as that which belongs to this country. So the idea that they would be tried there and there wouldn't have to be evidence and they could be tortured is inappropriate. The most recent Military Commissions Act of 2009, which revised the one of 2006, has gone as far as any document since the beginning of the war on terror to specify how the military commission system would work. The evidentiary standards are greatly lowered from the federal system. Hearsay will be allowed, but tortured evidence, it seems, will not be allowed. And so it's hard to say, you know, who we could try of the most high-value people if we tortured them. And that's really the issue that you're getting at, and what are we going to do with these 47? The question is it because of how we treated them that we can't release them, or is it because we don't have information on them that we can't release them, or what exactly is the reason that we can't release them? Since the very beginning of the opening of Guantanamo in January of 2002, maybe a little later that year, this number of around four dozen has been the number of detainees that would have to be kept no matter what, which makes me kind of curious about who these people are. And to date, we really don't know who's on that list that you referred to of the ones mm-hmm. that we'd have to keep no matter what. So if the issue is, you know, how does this new material affect this process? I think there are two ways. One is we may actually have more information than we thought we had about some of these individuals, and maybe that could encourage a kind of judicial process rather than just kind of limbo. And the second thing is what I said before, is that maybe, you know, this will empower the administration to say, look, we told you we needed to keep them. But that's something we're going to have to see as time goes forward.
We have about 2 minutes left, and I want to touch two other things. One is just the curious case of a detainee named Kumu, a Libyan detainee. He was picked up in Pakistan and spent 6 years at Guantanamo Bay. Gaddafi was requesting Kumu's release into his custody in Libya. Kumu was released in late 2007. Gaddafi then released him within Libya last summer, and now, lo and behold, he's fighting with the rebels against Gaddafi's regime. How did this happen?
This is very much not good news from and how it happened, you know, is that there is a high risk of the war on terror proceeding in exactly this way. People we detain, people we don't know what to do with, then we let them go. We're not really sure who they are. So much of this depends on cooperation with countries that they are let go to.
It seems like Gaddafi didn't know who he was either.
Probably not. And we don't know who he was in terms of when he got radicalized and when he got into the process and when, you know, he got to this stage. I mean, it's hard to blame it all on Guantanamo. It's hard to say, well, we should have known when he got out that this could have happened to him, because we don't know exactly when and where and how and why. And there's an assumption that if you leave Guantanamo and you then engage in radical behavior, that we should have known and just keep you there. Well, under that theory, we should never release anybody from anything, and that's just not how our country works. So again, it's about the need to have intelligence about people you're going to incarcerate and people you're going to judge and people you're going to try and people you're going to let go. And since the beginning of the Guantanamo episode, we have had a very difficult time of knowing who we had and how to assess their danger. And I think, you know, one of the things that we really need to do in this country is to sit down and say, how do we assess risk and danger? What are the criteria? Syria. And to my knowledge, there's no clear understanding of that, and certainly not one that's been shared with the public.
So before you go, there's been this enormous pressure to close Guantanamo as a prison. Has this pressure contributed to releasing higher-risk prisoners than the administrations would have liked to? And beyond that, does this release go toward making the case that Guantanamo should not be closed?
Mm-hmm. Very, very good question. And I would say, well, you know that I want Guantanamo closed. What I would say is you can close Guantanamo without letting everybody free. And that to think that these two things are mutually exclusive is probably wrong. You can find out another way to try or incarcerate individuals. But again, this what's amazing about Guantanamo is that the issue does not get any clearer. And in the quote you had from President Obama, where he referred to them as prisoners of war, you see the nugget of the problem. They are not prisoners of war. And by denying them that status early on in the process, this entire murky category was created. They are not prisoners of war. This administration has chosen not to make them prisoners of war or anybody else we're capturing, and therefore we will have this problem with us for a very long time.
Karen Greenberg, Executive Director of the Center on Law and Security at NYU Law School. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and still to come, in fact, coming up next, we will have one of our occasional call-ins for those of you who regularly get your news in a language other than English. This was so successful last time we did it that we are making it a semi-regular feature. So if you can tell us what the non-English news source that you are reading or listening to is talking about today, give us a call right now, 212-433-WNYC. Anything that you're consuming in the news department, not in English, call and tell us about it, 212-433-9692. And then after that, did you go to sleep in Crown Heights and wake up in Procrow? We'll look at the new proposal to stop real estate agents from renaming your neighborhood. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.